Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to The Business Alchemist, where we believe in serving with spirit. I'm excited for my guest today, truly excited for so many reasons. Today we have Grammy Award winning recording artist Grissette Michelle with us here today. She's also newly crowned TEDx speaker who just launched her brand new podcast, Comeback Sis. She's weathered the journey of a 15-year career topping the Billboard pop and R&B charts, collaborating with artists such as Jay-Z, John Legend, Rick Ross, and so many others, and touring the world. She's experienced cancel culture firsthand. She understands love, marriage, and divorce. You guys are gonna hear today from someone who's been around titans. She's still so grounded. She's still so humble, and her spirit and her heart are so big. And we had a very, very spiritual conversation, just girl talk, which I loved the most about Grissette Michelle. I hope you guys really enjoy this episode. All the links about Grissette will be in the show notes. And as always, leave a rating and a review. Enjoy this episode. I love you guys. Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to The Business Alchemist, where we believe in serving with spirit. I am so excited for today's guest for so many reasons. More than anything that you've done in the physical world, I love what you have on your bio on Instagram. You wrote, "It's really not about me." So I'm excited to get to know your heart, your spirit here today. So Grissette Michelle, welcome to The Business Alchemist.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And yes, it's really not about me. I'm glad you picked that up.
People see us online or they get to know us as humans, but I'm excited to get to know your soul today. So before we get into like all the fun stuff, take me to the beginning. What was young Grissette like growing up? What was the experience that really helped mold who you are today?
Sure. So I was raised on Long Island in New York. And so that is literally what made me. It was the grass. It was the forest. It was this just playground that my parents gave me, and they allowed me to be curious from this time I was really young. We would make things out of the couch, and the dining room table would be a band shed. The pots would be drums. And so there was always this attitude of play and this comfort in playing. I know that sounds almost normal, but the weird part of it is that my dad played too and my mom played too. And she sang and he played instruments. And then they had these real jobs. My father was a teacher, but in the prison space and in the juvenile detention center space. And my mother was in behavioral psychology in the special education space. So this playfulness and this behavioral awareness kind of became who we were as kids. And that sent me off to school for vocal jazz performance to continue to play. Then I went to college for vocal jazz performance. And then immediately at the end of college, I got signed with a record deal, put out my first album, won a Grammy right away, went to number one in the Billboard charts on the second album. And I've been touring around the world ever since. So that's the start to the middle.
Yeah, I love that so much. So guys, now I'm going to name drop, if I may, a little. So Grissette Michelle has worked with some of the greatest people from Jay-Z, Rick Ross, Nas, you name it. At what age, because I know like the curiosity and your parents kept that door open for you, but at what age did it really, like, you really understood, like, this voice is an actual gift?
Yeah, I'll make a long answer short, and then I'll answer really pragmatically, right? The long answer short is I never didn't know I had a gift. It was just the same way one might walk or one might stand or one might see. I sang. So it wasn't this, oh my goodness, there's something special about me. It was, mom is on the microphone. Pass me a microphone. Mom's singing while she makes spaghetti. Pass me, you know, let me make up a song. I was so amazed when I found out that these songs she was singing, she was making them up while she was saying them. I couldn't believe it. and then move on to meeting Jay-Z, and he's making up songs in his head while he's singing them. That part I felt like was not normal. That part, yeah. The songwriter part was when I became fascinated, because I realized that I could do whatever I want and then sing it, wow. Right? So that was the exciting thing. And that is where the business side of me sort of kicked in. When I got signed to Def Jam, the business side of me still hadn't kicked in. The way in which I got signed was through other people saying, your gift belongs here. So I was led to a lot of the places that I got to. But when I finally got to where I was supposed to be to offer my offering, and that's a key, right? Because some of us are pushing our way to get to that place. But for some reason, I arrived at that place by following other people's leadership and guidance. When I finally got there, I realized, okay, I have something that no one else here has, and that's my songwriting capability. And when I found out that you could get a publishing deal for your songwriting capabilities, you could sell your songs to other people. There were royalties that would pay your rent or your mortgage for the rest of your life if you wrote the songs. That's when I began to fight for my right to write. And so that particular gifting, that particular skill set is more of my business side than singing is.
Now, being around some of these titans, it can be intimidating, especially in my opinion, maybe especially as a female around these titans, Jay-Z, Rick Ross, Nas, Babyface, John Legend, you know, the list goes on. How did you keep yourself grounded through that experience and that journey to not lose yourself in that world?
Yeah, I love that question. The deeper I sit into my femininity, into the intimidation, into the I'm not you, into the I'm not like you, the deeper I sit into just the femininity of myself, the less intimidating men are. Mm-hmm. They love the feminine energy. They love the seat that you take. And when you take it, they feel safe because they're just as afraid when you're trying to be like them. So they're just as nervous. They're just as uncomfortable if you're walking in with this masculine energy trying to, you know, take up the same space they take up. So my advice there really is to just kind of sit in the softness that you naturally are. And that's just as big of a statement as they are. It's just as, I'll put it in quotes, intimidating to them as we are of them. So I think it's about just being seated and relaxed and comfortable as you are. Does that make sense? I hope it wasn't too.
No. Well, here at the Business Alchemist, we get woo-woo. We get as woo-woo as possible. But I love that because people, you know, if you look at how people treat, and me personally, I understand, I'm aware that we have this term called celebrities and people, you know, get shocked, but I love that you put into such an energy, you know, like it's an energy. So if you walk in with the same confidence, you may not be a celebrity selling out, not you, I'm saying anyone listening, you at home or in your car, wherever you are, you may not be this celebrity, what the world sees, but it is an energy. So when you do meet someone of high status or a celebrity, if you come in with the confidence and see them as an energy, as a person, that's a frequency too, right? And they will, whether be drawn to that energy as well or on the same wavelength. And I feel like when you're on the same frequency, you can trust each other more because you can't, I always say you could lie to your peers, you could lie to everyone, but you can't lie to God, source, and the universe. So if you're coming into, whether it's a business deal, a relationship with the intention of, oh, this celebrity, I want to get close. You know how people can read that real quick. And I feel like actually the more successful someone is, the more guarded we have to be with our energy. So I love that answer because that is very powerful. Energy is everything. Now to go back to energy, at what age or when, since you always knew you had a gift, but when did you start to understand energy?
Energy is synonymous with music industry. Mm. It's literally how it functions. And when I tell you, you literally did such an incredible job of describing it just now. And second of all, I love the name of your podcast, business alchemist because everything is alchemy. Mm-hmm. We decompartmentalize the physical from the alchemy or the spiritual or the makeup of things, and we wonder why we're disconnected. You're immediately disconnected as soon as you're not walking with God. Mm-hmm. It has to be both end at all times. You cannot ever go into a room without your energy. You can't. You will not succeed. The only thing that is successful about anyone is their ability to walk in their energy wherever they go. Otherwise, everything will rip you to shreds. So I'm obsessed with what you're saying. I'm fangirling with what you're saying because you are brave enough to put the word business. Mm. You understand that you need both. And you're brave enough to match it up with alchemy, which is one of the words that if you understood it first energetically, then you don't understand anything else. Does that make sense? It's not a foreign concept when it's all you know.
Yeah.
And when you're like this and you walk in that God space at all times, business is just an opportunity. Ooh. It's like, oh, I can sit here and you sit there and you receive until it's time to receive something else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that energy component is how you walk in this business. It's how you walk in life. And it's what the music industry is made of. Every studio that you walk in, the beginning of the session is always everybody assessing each other's energy. They don't use those words. Sometimes they do, especially if you're in LA. Sometimes they do. Or if you're in Arizona, you know, naturally, that's okay. Just Miami. Certain places just lend themselves to, let's assess each other's energy. You know, like it might be a whole, let's meditate for a half an hour. Wow. In other places, it's conversation. Because words carry the energy that are inside of your heart. And so people are absorbing each other before they create together. And that's how you walk into the business. I'll never forget the first time I was given the assignment to assess someone's energy. I was standing in front of Jay-Z a couple of days after I'd just gotten signed. And he was the president at the record label that I was signed to. And so I remember being nervous, which is a energetic disconnect, right? It's like, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, you know. And he, to me, was what you were saying celebrities are. What can I get from this person? Can this person see me? Will this person affirm who I am? Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows this, but I was a rapper first. Rap and jazz were my first two loves. So I had waited all this time to rap in front of Jay-Z. And I stand in front of him and I look at him. And to me, in my mind, he is a mogul. And I told him I could rap and he goes, well, rap right now. And I clammed up. I completely caved. Jay-Z, India Arie are two of the people who I caved in front of and who they saw me anyway, took me under their wings and took me to my first level. So it's nice when people will forgive you for not knowing what you're looking at and pull you in anyway. But yeah, that was my first assignment to be okay with how big he was and rest in my talent. And I failed miserably.
You know, I am like shocked right now. Before we even began filming, I just put out like a very quick TikTok video because I am, you know, nervous to meet you. And sometimes that happens. And I said, you know, anytime someone's nervous, just say a prayer, you know, God, source, universe. If you ever feel me blanking out, keep the lines of communication open. And I actually did that before our interview. And, you know, you're saying this now. So to anyone listening, like that's normal. But when you really build up your confidence and you build up your energy and you are willing to co-create with God, source, universe and ask for help, because sometimes, you know, that's the thing. Our ego's like, oh, I'm so great. And then you stand in front of greatness. And you're like, oh, wait, hold on.
I love that prayer. Sarah Jakes, the Roberts, she says the same prayer before she preaches.
I love
she
that.
She says, no nerves, no anxiety right before she goes up. And she says, all you, none of me. Like it's the, I love that.
I did it right before our interview. I'll be honest. I was like, keep the lines of communication open here. So I love that it's flowing. So, but here's the thing. We are still human. Like we could have the confidence. We can have that. And so what do you do when you're going through adversity now, being that you are working on this energy, the confidence, you're doing amazing things. You just did a TED Talk. Congratulations. I congratulated you before we recorded, but to anyone, she just did a beautiful TED Talk that you can find online. And it's on her social media clips, which will be in the show notes. But how do you work through adversity, knowing everything you know now about energy, about God, source, universe? What do you do when you're having that kind of a day?
Yeah. Let me think of a day where it was really uncomfortable. Oh, you know when it's uncomfortable? Dating.
Oh, well, let's go there.
I just, the first thing I came, like dating, like we're being interviewed, right? On those first couple of dinners and they're deciding where you fit in life. It is this onslaught of what feels like judgment. And the question is, do I defend myself? Or do I sit still and just be watched? And what I'm learning is that if you can sit still and just be watched and not feel any obligation to defend, not feel any obligation to offer more than you have, it's the safe space for you. You can create your own safe space. A lot of times we want to respond just because someone's asking a question, and that's not fair to us because we don't always have an answer. Somebody might say, what's your favorite color? I used to get so much anxiety around that question because I have four favorite colors. And I'm like, how on earth am I supposed to just choose one color just because you asked the question? Then you become defensive. Mm-hmm. Then you manage confrontation and then you come off as angry and defensive. So now I just say pink, purple, turquoise, and Swarovski. Mm-hmm. And that's how I approach life is like, I don't have to stop being curious just because you're curious about me. I can stay curious. I can change my favorite color tomorrow. And you might ask me again, or you might bring me pink, purple, and turquoise and Swarovski roses. And I would say, you know what? These are really nice. And they say, they're your favorite colors, right? And I might say, no, my favorite color is orange. I can change my mind. We're so worried about offending everybody else that we don't even give ourselves room to grow, to experience, to be curious, to tell whatever truth we have today. So dating and just interactions with human beings. There was a cleaning lady in my room today, just now. And I don't know if she speaks English. I don't think she does. And I said, I have an interview. I'm going to need you not to vacuum today. And the whole interview, she's looking at me, asking questions like this. I could be really upset and say, there's a language barrier. You don't understand what I'm saying. Or I could find like curiosity. I could stay curious and say, okay, what's another way for me to communicate with this person so that we can be on the same page so that I'm not defending myself. I could have said, don't you know I'm in an interview right now? But instead I said,
yeah.
Mm. You know what I mean? We're just on defense all the time. And I think we tire ourselves out. We miss out on this type of communication we can have. And I don't think we stay at center. And so we're never discovered. We feel unseen.
Mm, that was powerful. Stay at center. Because that was like my next question. When we do so much inner work on ourselves, right? And we finally, and I say finally, because anyone that's ever done the inner work, you know what that moment feels like where you're done people pleasing, you're done overextending yourself, you're done oversharing. Oversharing is a real thing. You're done doing all of that. And you finally you feel like you just centered yourself and you finally get to know who you are. And then you actually move slower in communication, in observation. And when you get to that place, everything is energy. Even you just said that with, you know, the cleaning lady, it's telepathic, but it's not. It's like, can I send this frequency where someone can understand me and say less, but can you understand? Now, let me ask you another question. There are people who sometimes they just don't get it. What do we or how can we handle those kinds of people? I know people are like, oh, maybe don't talk to them, distance yourself. What do you do when, you know, you're at this place, you're grounded, you're centered, you have this beautiful energy, you know who you are, and, you know, with dating also, maybe it's, you know, dating, maybe it's friends, maybe it's business. How do you handle energy that you could just feel it's just not on the same wavelength as you? How do you now go about those kind of energies?
Okay, I need your advice here. Finding is that the more I get into moving away from defense, the less I notice people not getting it. I don't notice it anymore. I don't know if that means that it stopped happening or if I was hyper focused on negativity, but I don't see it as much. The more comfortable I am in my seat, the less opposition I see. I don't know how that works, which is why I'm saying I could use your advice there, because maybe you've had that experience where you're like, I'm here and I'm present and everything's okay. And everything's okay. And I don't feel opposition to things being okay. That doesn't mean there aren't things going on, but they're not bothering me. Mm-hmm. I don't feel bothered. I hate the term unbothered because it sounds so rude, but I'm literally without any interference. Has that ever happened to you?
I'm getting there. I can't say I'm there yet. I could say that it is specifically with, I think there are people where I'm observing their behavior in my life. I'm observing, right? I may not be bothered by it, but I'm observing it and I don't necessarily agree or want that frequency around me. So I'm at a place where, like, how do I navigate with what I just observed? Do I call it out? Because that's going to start like a friction. They may not understand even where I'm coming from, right? Maybe they don't want the kind of life I want. Maybe they're comfortable where they're at. Like, who am I? Right? Because at the end of the day, everyone's on their own experience. So I'm at a place of observation without knowing how to approach things. So that's why I was like, how do we, you know, through observation, do we distance ourselves? Like, what do you do when you observe something that you're like, I may not be okay with this?
Got it. So I think that has to do with attachment. Practicing attachment, kind of not really being attached to other people's outcomes. That gives you more room to really love them wherever they are, because you're not attached to where they're going. You can just be attached to the beauty you find in them right now. But like, if it's your brother and he drinks too much and that's making you worried and uncomfortable and you're scared that he's going to die because he's sick as an alcoholic, I can understand being freaked out and uncomfortable and not being able to just observe that. And I can understand having to say to your brother, bro, this is getting really bad. Me and my brother had that relationship until just recently when he finally became sober, and he's been sober for over a year. And I think the reason why we're still friends is because even if he had a bottle of whiskey in his hand, I would work really hard to hear everything else he was doing. I would work really hard to see everything else that he was doing. If he hurt, I wanted to identify with the actual pain. If he was happy, I wanted to identify with the actual happiness. But I couldn't identify with that bottle of whiskey. I couldn't relate to him there. And it was really painful, really uncomfortable. And so I had to decide to love my brother wherever he is, however he is, and not be attached to what's going to happen. That's above my pay grade. And now we have this loving relationship. He made it through alcoholism, and he was an alcoholic for years, and we're still pretty young. He finally got engaged to the girl that I liked the whole time, right? We were talking behind the scenes like, girl, everything, we were like being attached to outcomes via text, right? Like, this is what's gonna happen, right? But we didn't tell him that. We just let him live his path. And I think what you're talking about is hope. Like, this hope that people are going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And when hope becomes worry, then it's above my pay grade. But hoping the best for someone, I don't think that's bad.
Mm. You know, two things popped up as you were saying that, the word grace, you know, and love. I really feel you helped heal, if not healed, your brother through just loving him and just being there. Like, sometimes we don't need to set our expectations on people. We don't have to tell them how we expect it to be. We just can be there for them. That is that, and that is so, I don't want to say hard to do, but that is where anyone listening, may we all get to that place, because that really is what humanity should be, if you think about it, right? Otherwise, think about everyone else in the world judging each other, and you did this wrong, and you did, and you know, it trickles. But if we can all stand in that grounded, I see you, you are where you are, I'm here if you need me, but it is what it is energy, then I really think that humanity can have a better shift than, you know, what's currently happening. Even with what's currently happening, I try to just pour so much love into the world, because there's so much fear already out in the world. So I love that you said that, that you really were just there for him, because we always talk about being present. And a lot of times, because I feel energy, and I could be wrong, so here's where I need your advice. You know, I could be wrong. Sometimes it hasn't happened in a while, but in the past, there were situations where, because I try to be such a light for people, I would be judged on that. Like, people would be like, you're too nice, you're too kind, why are you always talking about God? You know, and I would put myself in situations where I'd be sitting there in almost fear, like, I'm present with this person, but what are they thinking about me? Are they judging me? Right? So I can't be present. So in that moment, I should have, or just sat there and just accepted whatever was happening. Like, how do I navigate in those alligator waters?
Yeah, it's called trying to operate in a false narrative. I cannot operate in a false narrative. If everything that you think about me comes from a narrative that you created, I can't operate. I can't do me. I can't be me if you've already decided who I am. That's why judgment is so difficult. Judgment is not difficult because I care about what you say. Judgment is difficult because I can't be who I am for you. As much as I want to show up for you, you've already decided that I'm not here.
Wow.
Now that we have this false narrative, I actually cannot be present, literally. So I feel you. And that's a difficult part about being a celebrity, is people have these ideas about what a celebrity is before I even present myself. And so a lot of times I spend a lot of the first few minutes meeting someone just being seated so that they can become disarmed.
Mm. You know, I was listening. I love that, because that is so true. When someone has made that decision, then I think it's just better to just at that moment separate. If someone already has a conviction of you, then it is what it is. You can't try to live up to or try to change their mind. They already have decided, and it's up to their heart and their spirit to change that conviction if they want to. Now, I was watching an interview earlier with you where you said something very beautiful, which I know we're talking about, but I really want to know, like, what practices you have for this. You said something about checking your heart, like check in with your heart. You know, I know you went through a divorce and you went through it with grace. Again, everything through grace. And you said, check your heart. You know, where was your heart when you got married? You know, ask God, like, should have I? And, you know, I love that we're talking about dating, because I'm someone who I'm dating, and I'm dating through God. Like, that person has to be on the frequency. He has to, you know, be a man of God and understand everything.
Can we go out for drinks, me and you? We need to just go out for drinks at this point. Yeah.
You know, so it's been alligator waters, because I'm like, okay, you know, I'm observing and all this, but what practices do you have to actually check in with your heart? Like, do you meditate? Do you journal? Like, what are some of the practices? And going out for drinks with me besides that, like, how do you check in with your heart? Because I think sometimes for humans, because we're humans having a spiritual experience, real life takes over and we don't actually know how to check in. So how do we check in with our heart?
The first answer that comes to my mind is the answer that I wouldn't say, and then I'll tell you the second answer. But the first answer is I talk to old people who know me. Mm-hmm. I find the oldest people that I know, and I go and find them and say, what do I look like right now? Like, this is what I did. This is the choice I made. What do I look like? And I get quiet and I let them answer that question, because a lot of times experiential wisdom can see further than I can. So experiential wisdom is one of my favorite ways and most uncomfortable ways to look at myself. But usually when someone's a lot older, maybe 75 or 80 than I am, they have grace for my humanity. Mm-hmm. You know, because they've done some really stupid stuff too. And they don't hold the thing over my head, but they do see the damage and they can pinpoint it, tell you exactly where it is. And sometimes they can even tell you what they did to get through it. So that's one of my favorite ways to assess my heart's actions. But assessing my actual heart, a lot of times that's about me asking God, hey, Lord, what do you see inside of me right now? And if I sit still enough after asking that question, I can kind of begin to see where my action came from, what trauma it might have come from, and then I get to address that trauma. So it's between old people and God. It's usually not up to me to look at. If I go looking for myself, I'm just like, girl, you're fine. You know, let's go to Zara and get some new clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so true. You know, and it's interesting because I've never, and I love that because I've had people say like, oh, you can't take criticism. So I've actually started to want to take more criticism. I've started to want to see another perspective because I'm not always right. Was there a time I wanted to be right?
From older people makes me feel way better than taking it from younger people, because we are mean.
To that point, I feel like when we check in with God, we can cut through the noise faster. It's interesting to navigate in a physical world using energy in God when everyone around you has taken the physical form.
Yeah. That idea of time existing is a little bit exhausting for us, because if we subscribe to time, then we'll always wonder when, and we'll never get to be present. So when it comes to speaking to elders and people who have been here for a longer time, they understand that things happen over time. And that's such a nice way to say it, over time or above time or outside of time's constraints. They realize that. They realize how many things have occurred that they never would have imagined occur. And they occurred over time. If they only knew about their life at 18 and they didn't see what would happen when they were 70, they might have stopped at 18, but they let time continue and they rose above that, you know, experience and just looked down at their experience and said, okay, this is happening. Oh, wow, this is happening. Oh, wow. So I think a lot of times we're too in the experience. We're making too many choices. I don't think we have that much jurisdiction. I don't think we have that much power, that much control, and I don't think we need any. We are born alone and we die alone. Everything else we do with people, and everybody's different, and I can't figure most people out. I can't. I can only take one step at a time and see what happens. Mm. Do you know? And that's I think what I'm learning from my brother and a few of my elders is, the key is to not make so many choices. Mm. I know that sounds counterproductive, but if we make so many choices, sometimes we're just making things that have nothing to do with outcomes. We think they have so much to do with outcomes because we got to do something, but a lot of times we just need to do nothing at all.
So that leads me to this question that literally I felt like it was a download right now. I don't know. It's just like, it just came.
Sure.
And I would love to hear your answer because you're so full of this beautiful, graceful energy. So do you believe that things that are meant to happen are going to happen and supposed to happen? Or we as co-creators or whatever the terms are these days, or we can make them happen? Like, can we miss our mark? Can we not meet the love of our life? Like, is it meant to be and it's going to happen, or we do we make, is it our responsibility through energy to make it happen? Like I love to hear your take on this.
Yeah. And those are oxymorons. Can I meet the love of my life? Who told you had a love of your life? So if you don't, are you going to spend the rest of your life trying to meet him? There's too many variables in our quests. The quest is be. Mm-hmm. Quest is exist. The quest is sit. Really, we're vessels around spirit. And the only thing that's anxious is the vessel. The spirit is like, what's going on down there on the planet, you know? And our vessels are like, I'm horny. I need a kiss. I want more children. I need a house. When these vessels are gone, do you think it's still going to need a house? So we're concerned with a lot of like vessel issues. And the spirit, as much as the spirit understands, the spirit doesn't actually need a house. The body does. So we're dealing with a lot of like body issues. And that's what's difficult, I think. It's so hard because when you sit, you're really just resting your body. Your spirit is still doing stuff. And so the body wants to be included. That's the ego, right? She just wants to be, I want to do what you're doing, spirit. How can I help? And spirit's like, I got this. Don't worry. So I think the same thing happens with love. If I'm completely honest, I've met many loves of my life. Mm-hmm. I probably have more soulmates than somebody should. Should is a word I hate, but more soulmates than one would say one should have. Because I just keep falling in love with people. I just stay fascinated. I just stay curious. If there was no such thing as marriage and I didn't have the confines of religion, which I do and I'm thankful for, I'd be one of those people with 11 boyfriends, 59 kids, you know, walking outside in Arizona somewhere, smoking a hookah. Mm. That's who I am.
Yeah. I love that because yesterday I told my friends, I was like, I should be on a beach in Bali right now just staring at men. Just like staring at all of them.
Naked. Everyone's just outside. I just want mangoes and avocados and maybe some rice and beans. Mm. I don't need anything else.
Yeah. Like
who I am naturally.
Yes, I love.
Yeah, we put ourselves through so much because we're not still. Like, if you can be still, the spirit will lead you. Oh. We try to before the spirit leads us, and so we hit a lot of bumps in the roads. I've been there a billion times in public.
let's answer that right now because people are like, "What does it mean to get still?" I think people don't even know what that means. How do we get still?
Yeah, a lot of times, and I love to say what things actually look like. And so I'll demonstrate it here if you're watching. But a lot of times it just means closing my eyes and taking a deep breath, even if I'm at Chase Bank or at the zoo or at Kroger or Whole Foods. But like literally actually relaxing every muscle that I possibly can. If I'm standing up at H&M, I'll just relax until it means I can't stand. I may have to put my bag down. I may have to put my basket full of clothes down, but it actually means the actual words still. So that the only thing that I can feel moving is my heartbeat. And that's the place where I'll ask questions. What should I do now? And I'll do that picking out a shoe. I'll do that at a menu. Because the truth is, the anatomy of not knowing an answer is the beginning of anxiety. That moment where I don't know what to do is the beginning of anxiety if I don't get still. Mm. Still combat for anxiety. It doesn't mean that we don't keep going, but take a minute, like take a beat. And I don't care if I look silly at Forever 21 deciding between blue socks and red socks. I need a beat. Mm. I don't apologize for needing a beat whenever I need one.
That's powerful because that's you literally telling yourself and the world that, first of all, you don't care about judgment. And second of all, you're totally being led by spirit. So I love that.
I found I'd be out of my mind if I didn't live that way.
Yeah. And that's important to anyone listening. Cause I feel like even when I first started, to anyone listening, we're afraid to be judged. Like when I first started getting really spiritual or really doing the inner work, you know, I started pausing, I stopped feeling the silence, even on dating or friends. Sometimes if it's silent, let it be silent. You don't got to keep following up. Like it's silent, leave it, let it be energetically. It'll come back if it's meant to. And at first I felt like, well, am I going to be judged for this? Am I going to be judged for that? So to anyone listening, worry less about being judged and be more concerned about how you feel, because you're draining yourself. That's draining, constantly having to overshare and talk to people. And then sometimes to anyone who overshares, because I know oversharing is a huge trauma response. This is like big, I want to talk on real quick. Anyone listening, if you're still oversharing, what that feels like is you just had a conversation with someone. And when you leave, you're like, why did I tell them that? That's because you were trying to close the silence. Where be less afraid to be judged. And it's okay to be still. Like, and I love that you do that because you're not afraid to be still at all. So I love that. What sock was it?
When I thought about that after, I was like, I don't want blue or red socks. Now I'm like, I would never get a red sock. I always go for like pastel and ivory socks. Like those are my jams.
Oh, Spirit was like, wait, now I want to know what sock it was.
Neither. That's I should have never picked it up.
Spirit messed with you for a second. It was like, yeah. Oh my goodness, this has been
great. Can I tell you a really fun spirit story or a stillness story?
Yes, of course.
My favorite stories. I was in Asia de Cuba, one of my favorite restaurants in New York City. And in New York, I would just go to my favorite spots. Even if I didn't have a date, I would just go. And I would wear my classic red lip, flannel, skinny black skinny jeans and Chuck Taylors and a Ray-Ban. That was my just go-to. And I'm in Asia de Cuba and I'm sitting and I ordered everything on the menu without apology. And I sat in front of it and I began to pick one thing at a time because that was my favorite thing to do, is just try new things. And every once in a while, I would just look up and look around the room and just look at the beautiful people. And I would smile, not at anybody in particular, but just at the fact that this was such a beautiful atmosphere. Tyra Banks walks in and she's walking in with her like entourage and she's all perfect, like Tyra Banks is. And she just waves and I just wave and she goes and sits down. And the next day she tweets, I just saw Chrisette Michelle smizing at Asia de Cuba in New York City. My favorite. I didn't ask for her validation or her affirmation. I didn't know she was going to walk in that moment, but that was one of the first moments where I realized that stillness was absolutely okay. And that was affirmed by Tyra Banks. I thought that was a fun story.
That is so powerful because it's true. Like the first thing we do is like want to run up to someone, especially this whole celebrity thing, you know. Here's how I'll say this. I admire celebrities, that term, because of the hard work and the energy it took them to get there. Let's start there. Like that's why to me, you guys are titans, right? It's because I'm doing the work now, but like so many celebrities or successful people, they're ahead. But it's while you're doing that work, you know, if you're doing it, what it took to get there. So when you see them, you're like, I have so many questions. You know, you want to surround yourself with those kind of people just because you want to grow and evolve alongside with them or like them, not so much in a sense of like running and can I get something, you know. If you're going to get anything, get wisdom. Mm-hmm. If you're going to get anything, get wisdom. Get wisdom from these people that you look up to, right? And if we all got a little wisdom and love for each other, just think of what kind of a world this, I mean, that would be heaven. So obviously they don't want that here on earth, but you know what I'm saying? Wherever we're from, that's how it is. But I think is the collective is waking up. We hear this term, the collective is waking up. And one of my friends said something so beautiful yesterday. She said, if only every single person on this earth remembered what their gift is, started sharing it. And I sat there and I was like, wow. Because we all have, like, we all have it, but life happens, right? So if anyone's listening, what would you say to someone who feels like they have a gift, but life is very turbulent, like, and whether it's the environment, whether it's just life, whatever, what would you say to someone who knows they have a gift, whether it's their voice, whether it's a spiritual, but like, what do you say to someone who has a gift, but they don't know where to start? What would you say to them?
Yeah, there's a fun exercise I love. First of all, thank you. You gave me a new perspective for why people say hello to me. They don't always want something. Sometimes they see that I've done some work and they respect that. So thank you for sharing that. That was very affirming. So I love this exercise called the four seats. I don't know if I made it up. My therapist or one of my therapists showed me this thing and I was like, I'm going to do this forever. So you find four seats and they can all be different. One can be your couch, your ottoman, a pillow on the floor, just four of them. And you give them all 10 years of your life. So this seat here is me from 5 to maybe 10 or 11. This seat here is me from 15 to 20. This is just four different parts of your life that were fairly significant. And then you bring your gift to those four chairs or those four seats. And you ask that age of yourself, how would you play with this gift? What would you do with this gift? If you could do anything with this gift, what would you do? The five-year-old version of me, if she was singing, she would sing really loud and bop her head and play on pots and pans. Bring pots and pans to that seat. Play some really loud music at that seat. Just enjoy yourself as the 5 to 10-year-old you. Then bring it to the 30 to 40-year-old you. You don't want the pots and pans anymore. You don't want the music loud anymore. Maybe this time you want to bring your guitar and just a journal. Why? Start asking why you express yourself differently in each seat. And you'll begin to see what comes up for you. You'll begin to see what the five-year-old version of you is comfortable doing and why the 30 or 40-year-old version of you is or isn't comfortable with that. You have to explore all the eras of your life with your gifting. Take your gifting to all of the eras and sit in those eras for a second with that gift. I hope that helps somebody. And the reason I bring it up is because the only reason we lose our curiosity is because of trauma. And that's unfortunate and it's uncomfortable and it's not fun to talk about. But a lot of times when we stop discovering, it's because we burned our finger in the fire and we never want to go to the stove again. Mm. Get back to the stove. Start discovering again. Be curious and look at your life and then see who you are now. See what you want back. Play now, but don't forget first to go and look at who you've been, what you left behind, why. Address it, get over it, move on, and play. Does that resonate?
Yeah, because we're programmed through trauma and then we stop, you know, being that inner child. So my final question, which ties beautifully with everything you've said, is what would you, knowing everything you know now, tell your younger self?
I would tell my younger self, hey, Chrissy, you know all those books that you make up and all those books that you write? You're going to be one of them. And I would be so excited as a kid to know that. But I'm going to be a book.
Mm. Because it would make the fear less scary. Possibly.
Because it would be fascinating to know that my life ended up fascinating. It would be really cool to have known as a kid. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have had to read so many other people's stories. I wouldn't have had to sit in the biography section for hours and hours. I was a library junkie. The library is my first job. I loved books. My reports in school would have leather bound fake leather bound binding. I was obsessed with books. And if I would have known that one day I'd be a book, the Bible calls it a walking epistle, a living epistle. If I knew that one day I'd actually be a book, that it'd have a whole entire story. The thing I find most fascinating is life is that you create things or that things pan out. Stories are balm to me. So if I would have known at like 7 or 8, you know how you're playing in all this Anne of Green Gables and Babysitter's Club, there's going to be a book called Chrisette Michelle, and it's going to be fascinating. I would have been really curious about that.
I love that. So where can we find you? Everything's going to be in the show notes, guys, but let's say you're driving and you can't click on the show notes in this moment. Where can they find you on social media?
So right now you can find me at Chrisette Michelle with one L. That's C-H-R-I-S-E-T-T-E. M-I-C-H-E-L-E. My new podcast has its own Instagram page, which is Come Back Sis. That's S-I-S. And Come Back Sis is kind of where a lot of women are sharing that book, that story of their life. And we are hysterical laughing and hysterical crying all in the same episodes. It's mayhem. So Come Back Sis and Chrisette Michelle on Instagram. And then comebacksis.com is where you can go to listen to the new podcast.
Well, thank you. So it's been such a pleasure having you here today in the synergy. And I hope we can continue this conversation and friendship and whatever happens, but I see you. I'm really grateful that I got to experience your energy, and thank you for giving my audience your energy as well.
Thank you. Thank you for speaking my language to me and with me. Namaste.